Welcome to another ABC Radio National podcast. For more information, go to abc.net.au/rn.
It's not over yet, the 2 to 3 week long celebration of Chinese New Year, when Chinatown is laden with lanterns and flowers. And if you're lucky, it hosted a lion dance accompanied by drums. Hello, this is The Arc on ABC Radio National. I'm Rachel Kahn, and although I've seen all this many times before, what the Chinese do in the temples at this time of year remained hidden. And that's because the temples are often tucked away in the old sections of the city. The Sei Yup Temple in Sydney is so hidden that the seasoned cab driver was totally surprised when the Chinese gate came into view at the end of the lane. I was on my way to speak to the historian Helen Fong.
It's been extremely busy because it's Chinese New Year period. New Year's Day was actually last Sunday, but it'll be busy for the next little while. And because for us, Chinese New Year doesn't just stop on the one day, it goes for a period. And New Year's Eve was extremely busy. We would have had thousands of people there at some stage during the evening. And when I was here at about 10:30, we had the second of the troupe of lion dancers. And there were actually three lions dancing, and they were dancing on poles. So it was the most spectacular lion dancing I've ever seen.
Sei Yup Temple has been here, what, over 100 years. Why was this spot chosen to build the temple?
Oh, that's a very good question, because at the time this temple was built, there were very few Chinese people living here. I think the census tells us that there were only about 12. So it's different from the Yuming Temple, built by another group in Alexandria, which was really filled with Chinese people, market gardens and so on. In 1898, this area was a middle-class area with very little development. And next door we had the 95 acres owned by Sir George Wigram Allen of Allen and Hemsley, the legal firm. And so this area was really pristine. But one reason is that there was a Chinese market garden here. This area is very good from a feng shui perspective because it's a bit elevated. We have the protection of the hill behind the temple, and then we have the water in front, so that at the time the temple was built, the god Guan Di could look right out onto the water, and that's regarded as good from a feng shui perspective. But I also believe that the Chinese here were accepted by the local people. I think if they had had a bad response from the local people, they wouldn't have settled here. But because they were market gardeners, they would have been known to the people, they would have been selling their fruit and vegetables as hawkers every day. That's another reason why I think they settled here.
Helen, Guan Di, the god, would have to crane his neck a bit today to see the water. There's been some building going on that's slightly obscured the view, although you can still see the water. Who is Guan Di?
He is as well known to the Chinese as Confucius, but not well known in the West. And for us, the hero, the ideal man, would have his intellectual skills highly developed, and the exemplar for that would be Confucius. But we would also expect that such an ideal man, a hero, would have his physical skills at a very high level. And so Guan Di exemplifies that. You know, he's a very virile, sort of masculine character, and he exemplifies that physical aspect of masculinity. He was actually a real person. His initial name was Guan Yu. Guan Di actually means the god Guan, and he wasn't given that title for many centuries. Guan Yu was a military leader. He started out as a humble bean curd seller. He was actually a fugitive, and he was running away because he had killed a man who had used his powers as he was an official to oppress people. So Guan Yu met up with Chang Fei and Liu Bei, and they agreed that they would do their best to restore the Han Emperor, because it was at the end of the Han Dynasty and it looked as though the Han Dynasty would not be able to be reunited.
And that's about 200 AD or so.
Yes, yeah. That's right. One of the important things about Guangdi is that at the beginning, when he and Chang Fei and Liu Bei decided to unite to try to restore the Han dynasty, they swore an oath of brotherhood. And this is really important because Guangdi has become, he's got many attributes, but one is of absolute loyalty. In the Romance of the Three Kingdoms, which was written about six centuries afterwards, compiling together lots of accounts of his life and that of others, that is the one theme that continues through. He's incorruptible, totally loyal.
I guess that would have been fairly important for the new immigrants here. Is that how he is kind of employed in their day-to-day life? Do they look to him as an exemplar of these qualities?
Yes, loyalty is certainly one of the major qualities. But over time, he has acquired so many qualities. I guess people pray to him, various things happen. He's so benevolent, he's wise, he's also a god of wealth. So, yeah, he's got many qualities now.
Mm. I don't see any Buddha here, so this isn't a Buddhist temple. How would you describe it?
I would describe this temple as following traditional Chinese religion. Now, some people would call it popular religion. I find it more respectful to call it traditional Chinese religion. And that brings together a number of elements from Buddhism and Taoism and Confucianism, as well as other things such as the feng shui, ancestor reverence, you know, these sorts of things. But Buddha is not in here, but Guanyin is in here.
She's the female bodhisattva.
That's right, yes. Chinese Buddhists would also happily come here and worship.
Well, it's certainly active this morning. There are quite a few people bowing toward the sanctuary of the temple with their incense. What are they actually doing?
They are praying to Guangdi and the other gods here. Most Chinese temples, traditional Chinese temples, don't have just one god. They have one and then there may be a few others. So I would say what these people are doing is thanking God, or Guangdi, for the blessings they have received in the past year. And they would be hoping that the future year would also be good. They may also be making pledges. They may be saying, you know, if you can help me with this particular issue this year, I will come back next year and perhaps donate a plaque, or, you know, just come back and worship you again, or thank you, whatever. Yeah.
Well, as I look at the red doors of the temple, there's kind of a canopy overhead of swirls of incense. Are they always here, or is this specially for the new year?
They are always here, but they are more here today than usual because all the huge coils of incense have been donated. And you can see those bits of red cardboard with people's names on them. Worshippers have come and they have wanted to honour the deities in this way.
Can you tell me a bit about the building? Because it looks to be something of a composite of structures.
Yes, it has. The central hall was built in 1898, and so the builders were required to fit in with the buildings in the local area, and that always happens with Chinese temples that are in foreign lands. They'll always try to, you know, to fit in. But we have the central temple, which is to Guangdi, and then on the left-hand side is actually quite interesting. That particular place is what I think is one of the most important parts of this temple, and that is the hall to departed friends. And when this temple was built, the society, the Siyap Society which built it, had three objectives. And at the time, there were 10 district societies in Sydney, all with similar objectives. The major thing was to take the bones home, that if any of the people of their compatriots died here, their bones could be sent home to China, where the relatives could bury them and then, you know, honour them properly. That was one of the major objectives. There was also charitable works to be undertaken for needy people, primarily within the Chinese community, but also without. There were many donations to hospitals and, you know, other events. And for the Siyap people, they also wanted to build the temple and the hall to memorialise their departed friends.
In a way, you could say this temple began as a burial society.
The Siap Society, which collected the funds to build it, yes, that was one of their objectives, to be a burial society.
Mm. And tell me about Siap. Is that a region in China?
Yes, that's right. Siap literally means four counties. Our counties are in the southwestern part of China, as part of Guangdong Province. And in fact, administratively, it doesn't exist anymore. The Chinese government now has five counties. So if you try to look up Siap, it's not so easy to find information about it in China.
Yeah. Well, Helen, we've come over to a quieter spot where only the cats are talking to each other. Mm-hmm. And I see they're very well cared for by one of the women who's just fed them. But over the years, I imagine that Chinese from different parts of Southeast Asia have come to this temple. Have they left any of their marks on it? Is it obvious that that the temple has come into new hands, as it were?
Yes, that would be true, because there are different deities here that have been added. For example, Guan Yin was not here originally, but she has been added. And I think also the various worshippers, and I don't know where they are from, have given garments to some of the deities. And people have made various donations in the form of plaques with Chinese characters on them, Chinese sayings and so on. And these are very valued because they're difficult to acquire and so on. But I'm not exactly sure who was responsible for which one, so which country the donors may have originated from.
Helen, how long has your family been associated with Siap Temple?
My great-grandfather came here in 1904, and one of the interesting things is that this temple was kept going by the Chinese general stores, the Siap general stores, and these were not just shops, but they were like mini banks, their welfare agencies and so on, because the Chinese who came here and were illiterate could not access other services easily. So they would go to the general stores for that. And so you'll find in all those Chinese communities, not just the Siap one, that the general stores were very important, providing that leadership role. So my family had one of these stores, and there are five stores during the history of this temple that have been involved in maintaining it. So my great-grandfather came here in 1904. One of his uncles was a trustee, and then my great-grandfather Fong Bong followed, and then my grandfather, then my father Kip Fong followed, and now my father's cousin Chin Kun Kwong. So that's quite many generations. But I don't want to give the impression that it's only my family that's been actively involved. There have been several other families as well.
Helen, there are quite a few offerings being prepared in front of various images, and one of them is a horse.
Yes, well, the horse is well loved by Chinese people. He's Guan Di's famous red hair horse. This was an example of Guan Gong's incorruptibility. When he was once captured by the Chancellor, Cao Cao, the Chancellor sought to win him over rather than killing him. And he gave him all sorts of things, women, beautiful brocade, jewels and so on. Guan Gong didn't evidence any interest in these things. It was only when he was given this horse that he was really happy and grateful and bowed many times in thanks. And the Chancellor said to him, "What do you care more for an animal than for human beings? I've given you all these other things and you haven't condescended to do bow." And Guan Gong said, "I know this horse. He is the red hair horse. He is so fast. If I ride him, I can go back to my master." That was one of his sworn brothers, you know, so quickly, immediately. So people make offerings to the horse because without him, Guan Gong would not have been able to achieve what he did achieve. So, yeah, he's well loved for that reason.
Well, it's nice to see that animals get honoured too.
I think so.
Siap Temple is in Glebe, Sydney, and Helen Fong is the official historian. Next week, the story behind the unmarked graves of an old cemetery in Emu Plains. That's On the Ark with me, Rachel Kahn. Later tonight, join me for Hasidic Tales, those stories of the spirit sprinkled with humor, piety, and the mysticism of Eastern Europe. On the Spirit of Things, tonight, after the news at 6.
You've been listening to another ABC Radio National podcast. ABC Radio National, on air and online, with many of our programs available as podcasts or MP3 downloads. All the details at abc.net.au/rn/podcast.